Yes, I remember everything. I know who I am. I am the Doctor. I am the Doctor.
Dig out your Acme listening devices, make sure that Mr. Hinckley the janitor hasn't built a creepy fairground over a lost gold mine, and make sure there's no comedy animals fighting in the background, because Pieces of Eight is back.
We are carrying on in our trip through those sections of the Doctor Who universe, even the surreal ones, that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else that we can lay our eyes, ears, and hands upon.
And this week, we're having some cartoon capers with the Doctor and his companions Fitz and Angie as we enter the BBC Books world once again with The Crooked World. And Becca, just try not to get blown up with some dynamite, and maybe you could tell us a bit more about this novel by Steve Lyons.
Absolutely. The Crooked World was the 57th novel in the BBC Eighth Doctor Adventure series. It was written by Steve Lyons and released on the 3rd of June 2002. And according to the back cover blurb, the people of the Crooked World lead an idyllic existence. Take Streaky Bacon, for example. This jovial farmer wants nothing more from life than a huge blunderbuss with which he can blast away at his crop-stealing nemesis. And then there's Angel Falls, a racing driver with a string of victories to her name. Sure, her trusted guardian might occasionally put on a mask and menace her for her prize money, but that's just life, right? And for Jasper the cat, nothing could be more pleasant than a nice long nap in his kitchen, so long as that darn mouse doesn't jam his tail into the plug socket again. But somebody is about to shatter all of those lives. Somebody is about to change everything. And it's possible that no one on the Crooked World will ever be happy again. The Doctor's TARDIS is about to arrive, and when it does, that's all, folks.
And that really kind of sets the tone for what lies ahead. A bit of Looney Tunes, some Hanna-Barbera animation, and generally there's some madness that's just so lovingly done. Are you a fan of these sort of classic cartoons?
Oh, I love them. I mean, I grew up on them, Saturday morning cartoon watching with a bowl of cereal, you know. It was, yeah, Roadrunner.
Meep, meep. Yes,
bleep.
I absolutely love Roadrunner. Roadrunner is probably my favourite cartoon character. But there's just such a great mix in here, that, which are definitely not Scooby-Doo. There's definitely not Scrappy-Doo. There's definitely not Tom and Jerry. There's definitely not The Perils of Penelope Pitstop and The Hooded Claw. But one thing it definitely is brilliantly, brilliantly realised. I mean, just the whole concept of it is just nuts. You would never, ever, ever think about putting them together. I mean, you'd... The tone is set from the cover.
Of course. When the book's cover was released, before it was actually published, do you remember what the reception to it was and what fans thought about it on release?
Ooh, good question.
Thank you.
I think there was a bit of... I think people were just sort of looking at it going, what? What the hell is this all about? As, I mean, at this point, BBC Eighth Doctor books were well into their stride, and as you said, this was the 57th one. And... The Doctor had, by this point, he'd still sort of lost his memories, but he'd regained the TARDIS and was pretty much carrying on being the Doctor, but just without the backlog of adventures from what had gone before. But this was just so surreal. And I think, I'm sure that I remember there were some online forums or whichever the equivalent was at the time. Yeah, it would be forums rather than social media. Because if this was out nowadays, we'd be like, what are they doing? Step too far. Doctor Who died today. All that kind of stuff, and things that we've seen in other contexts. But generally, there was a bit of what the hell is going on, but because it was Steve Lyons, people were generally, at least amongst my friends, were more than excited by it. Steve's a big fan of comic books. He'd done a bit of satirical sort of comic book supervillain, superhero stuff in one of his previous books, which was for Virgin, one of the new adventures. Yeah, Steve had done this in Conundrum, which was part of the alternative universe cycle with the Seventh Doctor, Ace and Benny. But here he takes it just to the next level entirely. and it's absolutely brilliant. There's some wonderful takes on characters who you may recognise, and do you want to detail some of them?
Oh, I certainly can do. I mean, I haven't read the book, but I have a very handy little notes page.
Yeah, but that's because you better explain that you have just been ultra busy. That's why you've missed out on virtually all the interviews this season.
I know, and I felt awful, but I've been so busy with uni work and work and life in general. I'm so sorry. So, according to the very handy page of notes, we have the skeleton crew. Mike Leader, Harmony Looker, Thelma Brains, Tim Coward, and a dog called Fearless, who travel in a van to solve mysteries. Definitely not a parody of Mystery Inc. from Scooby-Doo with Scrappy or Scrapper Dog. Jasper the Cat and Squeak the Mouse are obvious allusions to Tom and Jerry, where we know for a fact that Tom was called Jasper in their first appearance. The so-called Whatchamacallit bears resemblance to the Roadrunner, and Streaky Bacon's Elmer Fudd, and a bit of Porky Pig from what I have seen through my quick flick of the novel. Mm-hmm. The Masked Weasel, who repeatedly attempts to kidnap the racing driver Angel Falls so he can steal her fortune and poses as her guardian Mr. Weasley, are allusions to Sylvester Sneakley, or the hooked claw and the titular character from The Perils of Penelope Pitstop.
Absolutely. Not the hooded claw, but the hooked claw. Obviously, I love Penelope Pitstop. That was one of my favourite tunes. I think she might be a bit of a crush because I did quite like her southern drawl and the way she had her incredibly long legs that almost like she was doing the splits when she was running. And then, of course, there was always the hi-yo stuff. And then,
help.
Yeah, and being got out of trouble by the Anthill Mob, who had, of course, previously been introduced in Wacky Races when they were almost bad guys.
I loved Wacky Races.
Oh, far better than Fender Bender 500 when they brought that around.
Catch the pigeon, catch the pigeon.
Another great tune. Love them all, yes. Dick Dastardly and Muttley. Can I do my Muttley laugh?
Go for it.
Yeah, that's why I don't do the Muttley laugh too often. It's like the Dr. Claw voice. It sort of knackers you out as well. I'll get you next time, Gadget.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful novel, and it's actually still available, because I was actually just looking through Doctor Who magazine this morning, and there's an advert for Who Won, previously known as Burton Books. And if you're looking for a copy of this book, you can actually pick it up for $5.99, I think it is. Although you can pay a bit more for it elsewhere on eBay and the likes. But it is still available if you go to Who Won Limited, and I would hugely recommend that you do.
Plug, plug, mother plugger.
Language.
I said plugger.
Oh, that's all right then.
But before we chat with the novel's writer, Kenny, do you think we should listen to an excerpt from the book as we join our famous farming pig, Streaky Bacon?
Absolutely. I wonder who's going to read it.
Streaky Bacon cornered the Whatchamacallit at last at the top of a deep canyon. He stalked towards it, his blunderbuss raised, keeping it firmly in his sights. But the cliff edge behind it had nowhere to run, and its knees produced a most gratifying chattering sound as they knocked together. The creature twisted its long neck around. From somewhere behind its back, it plucked a sign which read, "Don't shoot!" But the farmer had no desire to show it mercy. It had taken him many minutes to climb out of his sandpit. He was all hot and bothered, and just plain cross at this goddamn cheating foe. His trotter tightened on the trigger. And then the air was split by a sound like none he had ever heard before. The air shimmered blue before his eyes as something slowly took on solid form. He realised that this was the source of the terrible groaning, and he wondered just how the Whatchamacallit had managed to pull off this latest trick. By the time he had regained his composure and thought to return his attention to the enemy, it was too late. An oblong blue cabinet had appeared between them. The police public call box read the sign above its doors in unusually neat lettering. And the pig farmer wondered if the sheriff himself had intervened in their dispute. He dismissed the question as the Whatchamacallit poked its head around the nearest corner of the box and blew a cheeky raspberry in his direction. The farmer pursued it round and round the obstruction, round and round, and even at one point craftily turning back on himself and running in the opposite direction. But he only tired himself out, unable to clap eyes on the Whatchamacallit again. At least not until a splayed foot reached down from the top of the blue box and knocked his cap from his bold pink head. He jerked his gun up, but the enemy had already vanished again. He whirled around at the sound of movement and leapt back in shock at the sight of two human beings behind him. The first man was a tall, gangly figure with a thin face and a pointed nose and untidy brown hair. He saw the pig farmer and his grey eyes widened.
Doctor!
His companion stepped forward, easing the first man aside to get a better look. He had inquisitive eyes and an innocent expression, and he wore a green velvet frock coat and a loosely tied cravat, which made him look like a cross between a dashing romantic hero and a vagabond in mismatched clothing. The pig farmer didn't trust either of the new arrivals. At first, he thought they must be strangers, but they couldn't be, as he was positive that he knew all the strangers in the crooked world already, and these people were strangers still. The second man grinned, his expressive eyebrows riding up his forehead. He stepped forward and extended a hand of friendship, and the frightened pig fired his blunderbuss at point-blank range and pumped a cloud of buckshot into the man's chest and stomach.
Now that is quite an interesting introduction, isn't it? Because it's not what you would expect at all, is it?
No, it's not. It's... Hang on a minute, who's shooting the doctor? Why are we shooting the doctor?
Yeah, why is Porky Pig, stroke Elmer Fudd, shooting the doctor? Why other cartoon characters? Why is there a pig farmer? It gets the questions going, doesn't it?
Why is there a pig farmer chasing a whatchamacallit?
Exactly. Of course, given that it's obviously not the Roadrunner, it's, at least it's not called something like the Street Surfer or the Avenue Advancer, or I'm trying to think of other
the alliterative. Park Walker.
The Park Perambulator. Keep the alliteration going.
Yeah. The Park Peruser.
Oh, Park Peruser's good. That sounds right. I like that.
Well, now that we set the tone for the crooked world, I think we should probably hear from Steve himself.
My name's Steve Lyons, and I wrote the novel Doctor Who, The Crooked World.
Welcome to Pieces of Eight, Steve. It's always a joy to see you and have a wee chat.
Thank you.
What was your first memory of hearing that Paul McGann had been cast as the Eighth Doctor?
Oh, I don't think I have one. I don't remember that at all. I don't remember where I heard it. Now I'm coming up completely blank on that one. It's nearly 30 years ago. I can remember calling in Sylvester, but I don't remember hearing about Paul McGann.
Because most people seem to remember it as being on the cover of DWM, and it was like that was it, with no or virtually no media coverage whatsoever.
Right. No, I think I must have known before that. I don't remember it being a surprise on the cover.
Yeah.
I can't think where that would have come from. There must have been something in the press, mustn't there? It wasn't a DWM exclusive.
Yeah, not a lot from what I recall, but some.
No.
And do you remember when you first saw the TV movie?
When I first saw it?
Yeah.
So the video was, the VHS was supposed to come out, was it 2 weeks before the broadcast? So our local Doctor Who group, we'd booked a room and we were all going to watch it together. And then the VHS didn't come out, so it got delayed. But let's say a mate of ours had a slightly dodgy copy with the effects not fully finished, and we'd resisted watching it. We'd said, no, we're going to be good, we're going to wait for the release. Well, we had this room booked, the release was delayed, so we put the unfinished copy on and we watched it in a function room in a hotel opposite Manchester Cathedral, and the bell ringers were active all night.
That's amazing. That's, I've never heard that as being your first memories of it. Even like people who were involved in the production, nobody can compete with bell ringers, so you're the winner, Steve.
No, they could have told me, unfortunately.
Yeah. Of course, by the time you came to write The Crooked World, you'd written previously for this Doctor, when you had done previous novels. So was it, how did you find the character to write for?
To begin with, it was quite difficult because the thing about the Doctors, especially when you're trying to differentiate them from each other, is that it's 90% in the actor's performance. And so what I try to do when I'm writing dialogue for them is try to imagine the actor saying those lines. And with Paul McGann, there was so little to go on. That was a bit tough. And I know with the first Eighth Doctor novel I wrote, I very much used what people have been doing in the books as a guide. It was late enough into the series that there were quite a few books out. And as I was reading them, if there was a line or a little gesture did that, I thought, oh yeah, that's right. I was making a note of that so that I could use that in my book, but that was more effort than I would normally have had to go to, because with the other doctors, I'm just, you know, so familiar with their voices, and I could just write what, something that I imagined them saying. So yeah, it was having so much less of Paul McGann himself to go on, you know, did make it more of an effort to just try to find things that he felt might suit his voice.
Because I'd imagine
that. By the Crooked World, as you said, that was my second novel, so it was a bit easier by then. There'd been a lot more books by then. The audios hadn't started then, had they? Did they start? Or did they start earlier that year? Was it 2002?
2001 was the first Storm Warning, and they came out.
I think I probably heard that then when I was writing The Crooked World, because that came out mid 2002, didn't it? Yeah. So yeah, I think the Crooked World, I had the experience of writing him before, and I'd heard, been able to hear a bit more of Paul playing the part, so that was a lot easier.
So today we're not going to talk about the Space Age, we're going to go for the Crooked World. So what was your thinking when you submitted a pitch? I take it you pitched an idea to Justin as the editor at the time.
More or less, yeah. It actually partially came from Justin, because we were on a panel together at Gallifrey One, and for some reason, the subject of Scooby-Doo came up, and I was quite enthusiastic about Scooby-Doo. And Justin said, oh, I'd take a Doctor Who novel based on Scooby-Doo. So that's what started thinking about it. And at first, you know, what Justin meant and what I started thinking about was, how do we bring the Scooby-Doo characters into the Doctor Who universe? And then the thought occurred to me, what if they did it the other way around? And suddenly that seemed to be a much more interesting story. And I'd quite recently seen Pleasantville, which I think is a fairly obvious influence on that book. And I really liked the idea of that, but I didn't quite like how they did it. It was one of those films that I spent a lot of time thinking about how I would have done it slightly differently. And I suddenly thought, oh, well, I can marry those two ideas together. I can use all that stuff I've been thinking. I can do my version of Pleasantville, but I can do it in a universe where Scooby-Doo exists. So that's where it all came from. So it was Justin that kicked it all off.
I take it you are quite a big fan of cartoons, particularly the, as you mentioned, the Scooby-Doo and the likes of the Looney Tunes.
Yeah, those would be the favourite ones, yeah.
Because I did wonder, when you started writing it, did you have to work out the rationality for it as to just how it can happen? Or is it one of those ones where you've got a vague idea and you'll come to it and sort it out at the end?
I think obviously by the time I start actually writing it, the outline is nailed down. But yeah, when I'm working out what could happen in it, it was, I realised that how the world came to be wasn't all that important. It was just something that was going to have to be covered at the end. So I don't think it was the immediate concern. I mean, you know, the Doctor Who universe gives you plenty of ways of having something like that happen. Yeah. So it was almost multiple choice, really. You know, which way am I going to do it? But it became, I realised early on that the story wasn't going to be about how the world came to be. That was just going to be something I had to fill in at the end. So I'm not sure exactly when in the process I decided on that, but it wasn't the important thing.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I particularly enjoy, particularly when you read the opening, when you're going through it and you're thinking, okay, here's Streaky Bacon, Porky Pig, here's the whatchamacallit, Roadrunner, and just all these other recognisable characters. And it must have been so much fun just sort of doing your own versions of them. And of course, they were nothing like the Warner Brothers originals whatsoever.
Yeah, I think I probably pushed it a bit, having the pig stutter. That's a big thing, because he was sort of, I mean, he was a bit of Porky Pig, a bit of Elmer Fudd, but then in his early appearances, Porky Pig is a bit like Elmer Fudd anyway. And then you give him the stutter and it's, yeah, I've just made it that character. Some of the others are slightly more, you know, the crossovers with other things. But yeah, it was just looking at the archetypes and, you know, saying what types of characters keep cropping up. In the especially in the Looney Tunes universe and in cartoon universes, I mean, you know, there are so many cats that are chasing mice and birds around, and they're always the villains. So that was a character I was really interested in.
And I think also the fact that there's a nice wee nod there with the captain called Jasper, and of course, there's some people may not know that was Tom off of Tom and Jerry's original name.
Yeah, that's probably something else I shouldn't have done. But yeah, that's where that came from.
Yeah.
I mean, Jasper is mostly Tom, but there's a bit of Sylvester and a bit of Mr. Jinx in there. You know, he's all those cartoon cats. But yes, I did. At the time, I thought it'd be fun to name him. I had to give him Tom's original name.
I love it. I mean, I think the fact that it starts off is so, you know, so lighthearted, and we've got the Doctor gets blasted by the gun, and of course he recovers. But then it's a very black comedy in so many ways. That was when I reread it. That's what I took from it. The fact that it's getting cartoon characters discovering violence and indeed death. And that must have been quite, you know, from your point of view, just sort of to try and look at how would these characters react if a bit of more real world came into the likes of Looney Tunes.
Yeah, it all felt quite natural, really, once I knew that that's what I was going to do. And, you know, as I say, that is pretty much Pleasantville. It's elements of the modern world coming into a black and white TV series. So this is elements of the real world coming into a cartoon series. And it just felt natural. I didn't kind of mean it as a metaphor for growing up, but I, you know, realised quite early on that's really what it was. It was about them discovering realities of the world that they'd been shielded from. So it all just seemed to flow quite logically and make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I particularly enjoyed Fitz getting it on with not Penelope Pitstop, and then of course having a little surprise when he thought he was going to have his wicked way with her.
I've forgotten that bit, yeah. Because it came at a time when, you know, I mean, it wasn't quite the New Adventures, but we were allowed a bit of sex and swearing in the BBC books. So, you know, that was all part of it as well, that, you know, that was on the list of things that they need to be introduced to in a tasteful way, hopefully.
So many wonderful characters, and then particularly when you introduce the whole notion of the supervillains as well, and coming up for names must have been great fun as well. Got the Green Ghost. What else have we got? The Masked Weasel.
Right, I've completely forgotten about the Green Ghost, and right now I don't know who that is. But I can see, as soon as you mention it, I know that I've named it after the title of a Three Investigators book. The Masked Weasel is the Hooded Claude, isn't he? He's Penelope Pitt. Hey, what did I call her? Angel Falls?
That's the one.
Yeah, he's the villain, yeah. I just had this idea that he was very... Yeah, there was a weasel and there was the Masked Weasel, and they're obviously the same person, and nobody ever noticed. So yeah, I wanted him, yeah, the idea was to make him like, you know, a distinctive race, a sort of character that isn't anywhere else in the world, and all he does is put a little mask on and everyone thinks he's someone completely different.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a fun one to do.
Yeah, I think the thing is, it's such a joyous book because it's one that makes me laugh, and that was something that when I first read it I thought the cover is great, it's really silly, and it sort of sets it up, and it's just such an enjoyable read. Was it an enjoyable one to write?
It was, actually, yeah. They aren't always, they can be a slog, but that was, as I say, because once you start along the path of what's happening to the characters, it did seem to unfold quite well for me without me having to think too much about it. It all seemed to come quite naturally for once, and because I was enjoying writing it and had an opportunity to just, you know, just put a lot of humour in it, which I like to do if I can, I think from what I remember about it, that was quite a pleasant writing process.
Particularly when it comes to going to Scary Manor and then you're able to unleash the Scooby Gang. That's the bit you're building up to, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Scooby Gang ended up not being the central characters. They ended up being quite minor characters that just come in when they needed. But they are my favourite parts. I mean, I love the the original Scooby Doo Gang anyway. And yeah, absolutely building up to that scene for the my favourite scene is when they unmask Boss Dog and they give all the reasons how they knew that he was the villain.
So the skeleton crew, to give them their proper name, with Mike Leader, Harmony Looker, Thelma Brains, Tim Coward, and Fearless the Dog.
Yes.
Driving around in the Spook Wagon.
I'd forgotten that name as well. Yeah.
But I think there's a bit there where everybody punches the air when Scrapper Dog is sorted out.
Yeah, that was, yeah. I think that was the first thing I'm going to say in the cartoon world, I'll kill Scrappy Doo. Now, what's the story going to be?
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. I mean, what did you think of the cover when you first saw it?
Well, when I first saw it, it was orange. Have you ever seen the bright orange version?
No.
It was the original. That was quite alarming. it was really in your face. So it took me a minute, but then they decided that was too much, and they changed it to blue. And I thought, it feels a bit toned down now. But yeah, no, overall, it's great. I mean, it's eye-catching, isn't it? It tells you what the book's about.
Yeah. Do you have any particular favourite sections of the book when you think about it now?
The one I said about when the unmasked boss dog, because it's the whole Scooby gang stepping forward and taking control there. Yeah, I think that's the biggest one. Possibly some of the stuff with the Master Weasel, because I find that character funny. And I suppose the trial of Jasper as well, because that's kind of at the heart of it, that it's, well, in a way, that is what the book is actually building to, when they have to confront the new laws and what that means for, and what he's done.
Because I think it's the fact that you actually get, I mean, it's like Tom and Jerry when you watch it. What would Tom do if he got Jerry? And because obviously he's never going to bite his head off. And then just the reaction, it's very much that it absolutely resonates now when you think about it. It's just such a shock to everybody, not just to Jasper, realizing that life does come to an end. And it, as you said, it's maybe subconsciously, it is that growing up thing.
Mm. And it's the way he's treated as well. You know, he is that housekeeper is bullying.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the fact that, you know, at the end we've got, you know, where all the characters have come from, the fact that it's a little girl who's passed away, and it's quite an emotional core, because when you think about it and put it in context, it's a very adult notion, sort of, that even children pass away, and that, which is sadly something that does happen. It must have been quite difficult, sort of, just, you know, to write that sort of thing when you've gone from the high fun and the emotion, and then you've got something that we can all relate to at the heart of it like that, and not just as cartoon characters, as metaphors, but when you've actually got something serious like that that can and does happen, sadly.
Yeah, I think that in the end I went for that origin for the world, because it is just kind of making real everything that we've been talking about through metaphor during the book, so it is just driving it home a bit, yeah.
When you think about it now, how do you look back on it? And you've written a hell of a lot of Doctor Who over the years, but how does this one fit in for you?
For me, I think it's my best work. It's just the one that everything came together. I mean, it's between that and The Witch Hunters. The Witch Hunters is probably slightly better reviewed, but that has the huge advantage of being based on real events. So, you know, it's easy to wring emotion out of tragedies when you know that the real... this felt like kind of was being more inventive. I was putting more into it myself. For me, I think it's the thing I'm most proud of.
And I think rightly so. I think it's, in fact, it's still so fondly regarded, because I remember at the time when it came out, when in the Glasgow Doctor Who group, when we were chatting about it, and when that was your only fix of Doctor Who was a book every month. And it was, well, obviously they were a big finish out by this point, but this was a real talking point, and everybody was raving about it.
Well, that's good to know. There was, I mean, at the time, the books were getting a lot of attention online, and you had online rankings, and it was getting a lot of good reviews, but there was just this, you know, little like rump of people that were getting zero. It's Doctor Who in cartoons, zero.
Yeah, it's that knee-jerk reaction in every Doctor Who fan for something or other, that we've all got that thing. Stuff. No, that's not what Doctor Who's about.
Yeah, that's too far.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I've got to say thank you from 20 years down the line. That's a scary thought. It's a fifth of a century since it came out. But thank you so much. It's a great book. It's a great read. And thoroughly urge everybody who's not read it to go out and find a copy on eBay or Amazon and buy it and read it.
Yeah, I love it, thank you. Steve, I've no idea what it's going for these days. I know some of them are rarer than others.
Yeah, but while we're here, let's have a quick look on eBay, see what current prices are, because you never know what some things are, because you see some of them for sale in the adverts that used to be Burton Books and DWM, and they still list them.
It's middle of the range, isn't it? So I think it's the later ones that tend to be.
I think this was number 57 off the top of my head.
Was it that late? Wow.
Yeah, I think I'm sure it's time. Just double check. I've got a handy book at my side here, and it's number 57. I did learn properly. Yeah. It's going for $8.99. $9.99 seems to be the price. So it's double what it was when it came out. So that's all right. It's gained some value.
Yeah, it's worth $7 now. Yeah. It's getting up in line with inflation.
Yeah. Well, it's a damn good read, Steve. Really.
Thank you.
Yeah. Really appreciate your time, as always.
Yeah, no problem.
Huge thanks to Steve for his time. It's such a fun book with a sad twist behind why it all happened.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, as Steve just said there, that it's almost like used a little girl's imagination to create this world, but then ultimately she was the last survivor, and then she passed away as well. So it's quite... Yeah, there's something quite dark to it. But then again, you think about cartoons, and they do have quite a dark underbelly to them. There's an awful lot of things like the violence, the fact that, you know, people have, in more recent years, been questioning cartoon violence and the effect that it has on children. And to be honest, given the amount of cartoons that I watched and the number of criminal convictions I've got for assault, which I think is exactly the same as yours, absolutely zero, it shows that these busybodies should take their noses and go and investigate something that's slightly more serious and actually probably slightly more deserving of investigation. It's a little bit more serious than trying to ruin the fun with great cartoons. Urgh.
It's the same people who say that video games cause violence. And I remember reading a study report, like a scientific article, mm-hmm. about an experiment they'd done, or like some studies that they'd done on children. And, you know, they had a group of children, and I can't remember exactly, it was a very long time ago that I read this, it's just one of those things that stuck with me. And they had a group of children, and they had half of them playing outside, and then they had half of them gaming for a set amount of time, and then they were all interviewed afterwards singularly. And the children who'd been playing outside, they were sat there, and the guy who was giving the interview knocked off a pen pot. And the children who had been outside jumped up and picked up the pen pot and put it back on the table. And the children who'd been playing video games kind of didn't acknowledge it, but were still very helpful. So I think video games aren't a bad thing and cartoons aren't a bad thing, but I do think we need to consider not the long-term effects, because I'm not saying they're a bad thing. Much of this time we are giving them.
Yeah, but cartoons aren't a bad thing. Video games aren't a bad thing. Do you know what is a bad thing? Busy
people
bodies who are
trying... Their noses
in. Exactly. Exactly. Go and stick your Murder, She Wrote nose somewhere else. There's a Lee Evans reference there for you. Quite. Anyway, we can come off our soapboxes now. And shall we have another excerpt from the book before we go?
Yes, I think we should. Woo, time to read again. I like reading. The doctor was smiling to himself, making circles in the dirt with the toe of his shoe. Come on, gang, said Mike, starting forwards. You know what to do.
What are you?
Yelped God as the skeleton crew jumped upon him. I've got it, cried Tim, pulling at God's head. You were right, Mike. It's a mask. With an integral microphone for amplification, I shouldn't wonder, said Thelma. With God outnumbered, even Fearless did his part, nipping at his heels. The outcome of the struggle was inevitable. He accepted defeat, his shoulders slumping as Tim Coward tore off his ornate mask to reveal a white oval head with black patches and long flat ears. Boss dog! Cried everyone in unison. Everyone but the doctor. Our first clue, said Velma, was when God was confused by our theological conundrums. A real and omnipotent deity would have been able to answer them. Instead, said Harmony, he told us all to sod off. Yes, said Velma. Now, sod, of course, is a synonym for turf, but it can also be a very rude word. So we knew we were looking for someone who can't control his mouth, said Tim. But the clincher, said Mike, is that when you spell God's name backwards, you get... Grunwald gave a cry of realisation. Dog! Bah! Grumbled Boss Dog. The sheriff wanted order, explained Velma. When he couldn't force people to obey his laws, he theorised that they might pay more attention to a higher power. Like he probably got the whole idea from Angie, said Tim. Everybody looked at Angie, who blushed furiously. She had already been wishing herself a very long way away from this insanity. She didn't want answers anymore. She just wanted to go home and forget that the crooked world existed. Better still, see if she could go back to believing that it couldn't exist. She resented the smirk on Fitz's face. But although the doctor's expression was neutral, she was sure he was thinking, I told you so. And I would have gotten away with it too, Spat Dog, if it hadn't been for you. You complete and total bastards! Well, that about wraps up this case, said Mike. Let's head for the ice cream parlour.
Brilliant. You know, two things have just struck me there. One, something I forgot to mention earlier, and something also that was super obvious. You were probably too young for the Dukes of Hazzard, unless you
no,
saw the film.
No, I loved the Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, okay. I am too young for them technically, but I have watched them.
Well, obviously, Boss Dog is obviously a play on Boss Hog. Duh.
Yes.
I've only just realised that, 20 odd years after the book came out. So, yeah. Gosh, 20 years in June. Well, there we go. And the other thing I've just remembered is that there's a brilliant bit in the book when Fitz being Fitz, he's constantly horny and after the ladies, and he tries it on with Penelope Pitstop, basically. And then when it comes to doing the deed, she's like a Barbie. And, it's like,
no!
Oh, yes.
Obviously, and with it being a child's mind, there wouldn't be.
Exactly. But then, of course, he introduces the whole concept of adult relationships, and quite a few of the cartoon characters get quite interested, particularly members of the not the Scooby gang.
The skeleton crew, you mean?
Exactly. And yes, there's, I think we find not Fred and not Daphne getting rather excited. And at this point, I am, of course, picturing Freddie Prinze Jr. and Sarah Michelle Gellar as playing these parts.
No! I just made the most horrible noise. I'm so sorry.
Well, you just put your thoughts back in your head. And
they are back inside my head.
Good. Good.
And exactly. And that, believe it or not, is our 13th episode of season 3 done already. And it's our 40th full original episode too.
That's
doesn't
amazing.
Time fly?
Absolutely amazing. I would never have thought
it is.
But there you go.
Interesting fact of the day. Mm-hmm. I need to come up with more facts. We can't keep talking about Mary Shelley, but I need to come up with some more facts.
Okay.
Next week, we will be back to chat about a more recent Eighth Doctor adventure, The Truth of Peladon, where we're joined by a couple of guests, including the real-life Mr. Livchenka.
Yes, absolutely. The real-life Barnaby Kay, who is married to Nicola Walker.
Woot woot. So, until then, I'm going to be reading The Crooked World, because I apparently have some catching up to do. And I've been Rebecca Chapman.
Yep, and I'm definitely still Kenny Smith at the present tense, and I have recently reread The Crooked World, and I'm loving it. And even just talking about it again, I'm thinking, I may just pop this on my Kindle and take it on holiday with me. And also, before we go,
yes.
I'm looking out my window, and to my left, there's a cloud, and it looks like a red panda's face.
That's oddly specific.
Yeah, it just looks like the face of a red panda. Anyway, that is completely irrelevant. We're out of time, we're out of space, and we'll be back next time.
We will definitely be back next time. So until then, bye!
Bye-bye, Duggan!